Hello and welcome to Let Them Eat Cake. This is episode 29. This will be a continuation of our last episode with Emma. This episode will be about the SHARP programs, which is Sexual Harassment Assault Response and Prevention in the US Army, which is a subject that she cares deeply about. As our other two-part episodes, the previous episode is not necessary. However, we do recommend going back and watching it as it gives a bit of background to who she is, why she's so passionate about this, and basically just her character in general. This is our third two-part episode. If you enjoyed what you were hearing, consider subscribing as you will be able to see our other two-part episodes as well as our other single episodes. If you're on YouTube, subscribe. If you're on Spotify or Apple Podcasts, consider rating us or giving us feedback. There's generally polls at the bottom of each of the Spotify's, so vote in the polls too, and we'll adjust our performance accordingly. All of this helps us considerably as we are a completely independent project. We have no feedback, so your feedback is what we want. And it also assists with our growth and helping people connect with what we're saying more. Hope you enjoy the show.
We have a weapon more powerful than the British Empire, and that weapon is our refusal to bow to any order but our own, any institution but our own.
I mean, there's definitely been a change in culture where there needs to be changes in culture and stuff like military sexual trauma.
Yeah, I saw you have posted about that a few times.
Yeah, which is a whole other shenanigan that happened on top of everything else. But yeah, I think that there's still that kind of raunchy culture in the military, and there always will be. And I don't care about it as long as it's not directed at me. And I think the reason that that line is so often blurred is that those jokes so easily get directed at women once women are present. And so, like, I don't have a problem if you're, you know, going to talk about something lewd or whatever. I'm not going to be all weird about it or whatever. But if you start trying to pull me into that or making it about me, then that's when I'm going to be like, okay, you can shut up now because that's not your business. That's like, you can talk about you and whatever you want, but like, there still needs to be that like boundary.
Do you find that if you get involved and like really sort of get into the I guess what banter, I guess you could call it. Do you find that it sort of pulls away from that where, because they're like, oh, you're in sort of in that sort of inside joke, that it's not so much directed at you anymore?
I think I have had other situations in my career that have just made me pull so far back that really outside of my squad that I run right now, I don't interact with a lot of people from my unit. And I have really tried hard in the past couple of years, and especially since I've met my husband, to create that work and personal life boundary to where like people didn't even realize that I had gotten married until I just showed up at work with new name tapes and they're like, wait, who is this? And for me, that's just because my mental health is better when I do that. I think another thing that's very common when females get pulled into that is females' personal lives get talked about in a much different way. I know that when I first got into Okinawa, I was dating a Marine and I was still living in the barracks at the time. So he would come to visit me in the barracks. And like, that was a point of conversation was, oh yeah, did you see Sergeant Malone's boyfriend? Like he came to visit her this weekend, or I saw him like leaving, or, you know, blah, 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 blah. And then like, I have a lot of guy friends because the ratio makes me have a lot of guy friends. So then that being like, oh yeah, well, I saw Sergeant Malone's boyfriend this weekend, but then I saw her out at this bar with this guy. And so like, what do you think about that? Or, and then I think like the barracks, I've never been a proponent for the barracks. Like, I think stuffing everybody in a building where they are privy to everyone's life at all times and not allowing people to have that like mental distance between where they work and where they live is horrible for mental health. I think it's horrible for stuff like SHARP because everybody's right there. You know where everybody lives. Like, it's just too much easy access. And people want to argue, you know, like, well, CQ is supposed to stop that kind of stuff. CQ is supposed to be, you know, like our duty is supposed to be aware of that kind of stuff. I don't think that that's always the case. Do I think there are situations where CQ is able to step in? Like if somebody's carrying a half drunk girl through, you know, the barracks and being like, oh, I'm taking her to her room. Yeah, CQ should step in and be like, hey, we can take her back. Don't worry about it. But like a lot of sexual assaults that happen in the military happen with people that you think are your friend. So you're not necessarily going to be in a situation where you even realize that you need help until you realize that you need that help and it's kind of like too late. Yeah, because even like my experience with MST that I've talked about, the Marine that I had been dating when I first got out to the island, just not a good dude. And it took me a really long time to realize that because of the backlash of everything that was going on in my life. And so once I kind of finally got back to a place where I valued myself again and realized that I wasn't the sum of a bunch of people's on the internet's musings, I broke up with him and we went our separate ways. And I thought that was that. I ended up going on a date with somebody I had met through Bumble or Tinder or something. Dating apps are so convenient for me out here, or they were, just because especially not wanting to date anybody that I work with and also not wanting to just go out to a bar by myself. Like that was how I just met people. So yeah, matched with this dude. We went out on a date. We realized that we knew each other because of my ex, because they worked together. And he and I kind of agreed like this wasn't a life-changing date. Like I don't think we're destined to be partners or anything like that. So we're not going to go out of our way to hide anything from him. But we're also not going to reach out to him and be like, hey, I went on a date with your coworker. And he wasn't going to be like, hey, I went on a date with your ex-girlfriend. So we kind of just go about our lives too. And he finds out, my ex finds out about it through some, you know, spider web of communication, because that's what all of the military is. It's just a gossip tree. And sends me this message saying that he thought I was like a better woman than that. And if I really want to whore myself out to his friends, that he'd make it easier. And that he had all of these pictures of me that he had never deleted. And he was going to send them to all of his friends so they could see what their options were. So I reported that shit immediately because
that's a crime. So
yeah.
Yes.
Fun fact though, and this is where a whole other part of my advocacy has taken off and where like a lot of my more recent stuff on Twitter has come from. The Marine Corps needs stuff like that to be reported to them very specifically. And the Army doesn't know those specifications because we're not the same branch. So we reported it as a crime, but that's not a crime in the Marine Corps. It has to be reported through PAC, which is like a personnel, I forget what the acronym actually stands for, but it's basically PAC covers sexual harassment and EO. And we didn't report it through that. We reported it to the police. And because of that, the police did an investigation because it was still a threat. But at the end of the day, the Marine Corps places burden of proof for sextortion on the survivor and not the perpetrator. So in the Army, they would take his phone and they would, you know, do a forensic scrub on it to see like, was anything sent? They obviously can't tell if he like just turned his phone around and was like, look at this, but to see if anything was sent to anybody. And the Marine Corps goes, well, how do you know he did it? I'm like, well, he threatened that he was going to do it. Okay, well, did he? How am I supposed to know that? I haven't talked to the guy in like 4 months and I don't, like his friends aren't going to like text me and be like, hey, I got this picture of you. Like, that's not the world that we're in. So like, I can't prove it. And they're like, okay, well, we'll send up this report to his chain of command to decide what they want to do with him. But I mean, he didn't technically commit sextortion because you can't prove that he sent anything.
I feel like that's a pretty massive hole in this whole thing. I feel like there should be an overarching branch that deals with this as a general rule, not the individual branches.
Yeah, because cross-branch stuff like that happens all the time. Like, sexual assault and sexual harassment don't just happen. Like, we always talk about, like, green-on-green violence or whatever, and that doesn't take into account that there's different shades of green. And that, like, disconnect that the DoD has as a whole causes more issues for people at the lowest level than is really talked about or realized. Because I recognize that everything I had gone through before with the ad put me in a position to be able to bring awareness to it and, like, talk about it a lot more. And I had the connections to be able to reach out to people at the Pentagon to be like, hey, I'm filing a congressional complaint. Somebody needs to be paying attention to this. This is ridiculous. So I recognize that I, you know, have that privilege to be able to do that, but I wanted to be able to use that to make a change. And so what the Army's trying to do now is change how we report to the Marine Corps and then change how victim advocates and SARCs are trained to report. So that way, when we report things, we're reporting them to the correct entities in other branches to allow investigations to occur to their, like, fullest extent and stuff like that. But yeah, like, stuff like that is what really pushed me away from interconnecting my life with my life in the Army so much, because I just didn't see a need for it. I wanted to begin to understand my personality as a person outside of the Army better. And I mean, my mental health was rocky for a very long time as a result of everything. And I just recognized that I needed space away, because for a long time I was just angry. And again, some mornings I still am, but I just wanted revenge almost. I hated the Army for, you know, what it had done to me and all that kind of stuff. But I realized that at the end of the day, there was still good that was done, even if it wasn't as visible. And I knew people weren't going to be happy about it entirely. And I still, you know, chose to go through with it. And really the only thing I can even hold a grudge about now is just the fact that my full name was used and that there wasn't somebody somewhere along the way to be like, hey, is that a smart idea? So, yeah, I can kind of just, like, take the positives from it and the negatives from it. And, you know, it's the sum of who I am now, and it's helped me with a lot of different things, and it's helped me help a lot of other people. But it has 100% changed, you know, how I handle my career and how I handle my work-life balance. And, I mean, it's changed my idea of my career, too, in the sense that I am getting out, so...
If you're leaving, are you still going to advocate for this sort of change to come in? Is that something that you're going to continue pursuing and pushing
through
further?
Yeah, so I am debating right now. I'm about to take my GRE and my LSAT. So GRE is just your, like, it's like the SATs for graduate school, in essence. And then the LSAT is like the SATs, but for law school. So just to give an institution, like, an idea of how well you're apt to do that academic performance or whatever. And the idea is, if I do better on the GRE, then I'll start my master's in social work, and then I'll become a social worker for the VA, because my husband is doing 20, staying in. It would be dumb for him not to, with his job and the money he makes and how much he enjoys it. Like, makes sense for him to stay in. So I'll always be near VA. So that would be the one option. If I do better on the LSATs, then I will go to law school, get my Juris Doctorate, and become an attorney. I'd love to work in social advocacy, veteran advocacy, stuff like that. I've toyed around with the idea of commissioning back in either one of those fields, but I think that for the time being, to gain some of the closure that I still need and some of the space that I need to kind of fully be at the point that I want to be, I just need a break for a little bit.
Well, and I was going to say also, just doing what you want to do, it would probably be better to do it from the outside than trying to change something from the inside.
Yeah. So the double-edged coin with that is, if I do it from the outside, I can affect, hopefully, ideas and policies that the Army has as a whole to help make change from a higher level or a larger scale. Obviously, that takes a lot of time and networking and all that sort of stuff, but the idea would be change at a higher level. The reason that I would want to commission is because of the individual help that that would, you know, bring forward, that I would be able to either be that behavioral health officer that, you know, can see patients as a social worker, or that attorney that can talk a soldier through their options in moving forward with like a court martial, because that's another part of MST that isn't talked about a lot, is like the actual adjudication process for that and how, you know, traumatizing that process can be, and that having a support system there for you during that is important. I'd love to be that support system and make sure that the way that the Army handles perpetrators of MST are dealt with in a serious way, because I think sometimes people fall through the cracks. So there's benefits to both, because it just kind of depends on what I, again, the day that it is, if I want to help, if I feel more inclined to come back into the great Army machine and but be able to help individuals more often or have a little bit more freedom. And
well, it certainly sounds like you're on your way, and it certainly sounds like despite all the negatives, it's ultimately been beneficial.
Yeah,
which is great. It's that's really good to see, because there was, you know, could have gone either way.
Yeah, I think the mindset that I've just kept throughout it all is to try to stay positive, try to see the benefits, because I mean, it definitely hasn't all been just a bunch of good days. There's definitely been times where I've been just pissed off and didn't want to talk to anybody, and so angry at like the choice that I had made to even do that in the first place. But the Army as a whole has allowed me to live all over. It's allowed me to be in Okinawa, where I've met my husband and have this, I mean, pretty amazing life that I have out here. I don't know a lot of 25-year-olds that own a house by the ocean. So that's pretty sweet. But yeah, I think it's been a place for me to learn from. A learning experience. I couldn't think of the wording, but yeah, it's been a big learning experience, and it's helped me in other ways that I didn't even realize, with soldier advocacy. And
do you think that the Army should be better at prosecuting these things than real life is, because these things often fall through the cracks in just regular civilian life as well?
Yeah. So obviously the military has a far more established way for reporting sexual harassment, sexual assault, I'd say, than the civilian world. Civilian world, there's not a whole lot of ways you can like check in. Like, we hear stories all the time about how hospitals have like rape kits from, you know, like 8 years ago that were never processed or whatever. In the military, because of stuff like, well, in the Army specifically, because of stuff like SARCs and victim advocates, you have that space to be able to be like, hey, what's going on with my investigation? And you have an advocate basically with you at all times. I think the issue is in how cases are like actually prosecuted. Like, there's been studies on that that point out how prosecution or even just like treatment of MST perpetrators are not the same severity as other crimes. I think Rand, I might be wrong on the actual one who did it, but I think Rand was the one who just released a study in the past like year about how pretrial confinement is used far more often on soldiers with drug-related offenses than on soldiers with sexual assault allegations, to the point that for them to be used at an equal amount, the person with the sexual assault allegations has to have at least 6 counts of sexual assault for it to be the same ratio of usage as people with drug-related conviction or drug-related cases.
Well, I mean, based on the history of America, that tracks.
It's wild, though, to like see that's
insane.
Even the military, because we push all the time, like SHARP as a very important thing. It's part of
your counseling. That's something that I see as the face of the military a lot. They want to push that they're taking it seriously, but I don't hear anything about them taking it seriously.
Yeah, it's an uphill battle sometimes, because I think the one pushback is that, you know, guys will sit there and be like, well, then I can't make the jokes that I want to make, or I can't, you know. And I don't think that there's enough education out there to understand the difference between a joke and then something that's like legitimately inappropriate. I think a big piece of that is just how sex ed is taught in the United States. Not every single state.
How it's not taught?
Yeah, really. The amount of states that like mandate that sex ed is taught doesn't even hit 50%. And then of that, I think it's closer to like 20%. 4 states don't state that the sex ed that's taught has to be medically accurate, which means that there's 4 states where you can potentially be learning things that aren't true.
It's all Christian stuff telling them that.
I went to Catholic school and I think my sex ed was okay. It was like, I mean, basically it was all like, here's the STDs that you can catch. And it was heavily focused on drugs, but I don't remember anything being like too bad. But I got my confirmation, and one of the days they brought in this group, insane group. They're talking about how if you have abortions, you're going to get breast cancer. And then they were literally like telling teenage boys not to use protective sex, saying that, well, they're talking about when you're married and you're having sex, you don't need to use contraception because you could plan around your wife's cycle. And then there's studies that show that couples that talk about their cycles and plan around their cycles are like happier and stuff. And like, I'm like aware enough at the time to be like, they're literally telling kids not to use condoms right now. This is insane.
What the heck?
And then we back to the individual classes, and like the teacher of the confirmation class is like, she's pretty young. Like, her mom does it, so she's doing it to like get paid. And she was so upset about it, just being like, that was the worst thing I've ever heard told to people. I don't know what that was about. Don't listen to any of that shit. Like, just imagine how mad you would feel hearing that you're going to get breast cancer for abortions.
Yeah. What the? Oh my God. Yeah, no. See, but that's like part of the problem is we have people who learn that, and then like California has a fairly good sex ed program. So we've got kids coming in from all walks of life with all different levels of knowledge. And then we throw them all into this room in basic training, and we're like, hey, don't do this thing. And then there's some kids that are in that classroom that are like, I don't really understand what that thing is, though, like as a concept. Like, I really like was never taught about sex, or I have never had like a lot of sexual interactions in my life, or like having issues with like sexual identity and stuff like that. So to start teaching like more advanced levels of a conversation when the baseline of understanding is so differential across different groups just does not make any sense. And the Army has always been kind of like one of those things that like pushes society to like change how they handle things. Like, this would be such an easy thing for the Army to do, is to create a sex ed program that gets taught in basic training that is informative and is more than just these are the STDs that you can get and how you fix them.
And especially because of how insulated the military is, they could really hone it down and really perfect it and get it really, 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 really good.
But I think the problem with that,
about tax dollars.
Yeah.
I think the other problem with that now is how many other topics people want to tie into sex ed, like sexual identity and stuff like that. And then that will just piss more people off, because
Well, you know, everyone should know that if Chelsea Manning wasn't bullied, then she wouldn't have leaked those documents. So if you care about the military and security, just keep that in mind. Ace and I just did one basically yesterday, and we were talking about a volunteer in Ukraine.
He's like the kind of almost like the face of the LGBT in the like Ukrainian military. Mm-hmm. But he himself just like the guy, his name, I think he said his name was Victor, is just like a regular officer and just an like a normal kind of like some sort of like heavy weaponry, some type of brigade like that. I don't know what the exact term is, but yeah, it's pretty interesting. Like he was saying that he's done a lot to kind of get the Ukrainian culture to be more accepting of LGBT people just through his media appearances and just through his work with like the individual soldiers around him.
That normalization does leaps and bounds. So I think like a lot of the times there's just a big disconnect between the tagline that the army will push out at the highest level and then how individuals are handled and then whatever is in between. I don't even really know if you can define what is in between that, but it's like the army will push out how important, you know, like SHARP is and how important resources are and SARCs and VAs and reporting, all that sort of stuff, like how important all that is. And then you will get taught that at the individual level because you're sitting in those trainings that are given by big army in essence, but that's somewhere in between there, you know, that message gets lost in translation. Or so I feel like if that weird middle ground is who makes the change into focusing back in on the whole topic of sexual education, that it will create a lot more change because it centers it back on the original topic, I guess.
Well, so you look at like corporations and they're normally pretty good at dealing with all this stuff unless they like are like game designers. If the army is run more corporate, it would make sense that they would be able to hand it more at a corporate level, but also the bureaucracy, just like it sounds like somebody is just getting an email and being told, like I have done like a management, there's such a disconnect from a lot of people at corporate, so I imagine which is then the same structures
ties back into like our whole first conversation. That's why they made the ad campaign the way that they did. It was because there's also a disconnect between civilians and the military. And the thing that we're seeing now is all of these things are kind of tying together. And like for the first time, I think ever, people are listing sexual assault and fear of experiencing MST as one of the top 10 reasons that they do not want to join.
I think that's one of the military's biggest issues.
That's like a benefit of media coverage.
Yeah.
Like just a lot of media coverage around the topic. And there's like it's very similar in Canada where I originally grew up. There were a lot of high profile like sexual assault cases within the military, within like the Canadian Military College, or the Royal Canadian Military College, which is basically the equivalent of West Point. Mm-hmm. And I think because the media kind of covered that and it was in everyone's face, which it should have been, right? that kind of like just put it on a higher scale. And I think just because of that limelight, so to speak, it almost feels like the military is in a position where they have to do something about it. You know, they have to treat it more seriously.
Yeah.
So.
Because it's always been there. It's always been an issue. It's always been going on. But it's finally being put into the public's face and into the public's eyes. And so. And
it's kind of like John was mentioning earlier, how a lot of people in the army are kind of like fresh out of high school or college aged and whatnot. And it just ties back to the lack of sex ed in general. It's like you have these people who are all pretty young, right? It's like there are going to be situations and interactions where they're going to, sex is involved. And if people aren't informed on things like just things that would be covered in basic sex ed, like consent, as we all know, is just because of the kind of stressful schedule that the military has, people in the military use a lot of, they drink a lot of energy drinks, they smoke a lot of cigarettes, they chew a lot of tobacco, and they drink a lot of alcohol. And so that just kind of all just ties back into it, where it's like, you would think this would be common sense. Like, okay, you're like 19, you're in the military, we should probably sit down and have like a 1 to 2 hour talk about like, okay, substance use, sexual education, how substance use and sex interact. You know, it just kind of seems like something, I think John or Jack or all three of you kind of touched on this earlier, where it was like, it seems like the military has to take things like this more seriously, because it is like a large scale institution, and it is a very well funded institution. And if anything, it seems like it's a more like intelligent institution almost, where it's like everybody has to be, not to make a pun, but be sharp. We know the military is big on professionalism. If something that goes really far against that professionalism, like sexual harassment or like certain comments that might be made that aren't, that kind of like cross that line of like a joke, it's you have to take that more seriously, because the military is like one of the biggest representations of a country. It's like really like just a microcosm of whatever country you're in, you know? So I don't know. That's
and
just
that's
kind of
where
some of my thoughts on the thing.
They're going to run into the issue of like hurting themselves, and like the messages that they push out about professionalism and, you know, like having military bearing and stuff like that. I mean, that's what I struggled with when I was going through my reporting process, is, you know, like, oh, we sit here and we tell people that we value X, Y, and Z, but then that's really only in certain situations, because then in this specific situation, it's not as important, and, you know, yada, 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 yada. And then, I mean, that gets more into the bureaucracy of how different branches handle each other. I think another big part of all of this...
I'm sorry to cut you off here, but something I did want to ask, kind of add on to that, is like, do you think there's a degree of complacency from the higher ups to like not want to even address these things? Like, do you think a lot of it just comes down to kind of like laziness and getting finicky with your job?
I wouldn't call it laziness as much as, what's the word?
Is like, complacency a better term?
Just the way it always has been. Because the thing that I was going to talk about is just that the Army doesn't also do a great job at creating a setting for healthy relationships. We don't like talking about aspects of private life in policy. We don't like addressing aspects of military private life in policy. Everybody in the military jokes about, well, to make sergeant first class, you know, you got to have 3 divorces, or, you know, you're not really a first sergeant until you've had at least 1 Article 15, or, you know, like we all make jokes like that. Or, you know, like some PFC, his first weekend as duty station, goes and marries a stripper. And I think that that's just such a unique military only understood aspect of the military, that addressing military sexual trauma as a whole opens just a giant can of worms to the public, because then there's so many other things that they need to address. Because if they start addressing sexual assaults, then, okay, well, why are we having to address so many of them? Oh, well, then why are these people in these situations in the first place? One thing that I have gotten told on multiple occasions is that the military is largely, I want to say 70%, made up of people that have at least one type of childhood trauma.
That would make sense.
So then I think one part of it is the military not wanting to cut back on some of their recruiting, because I think there's a fear that at the end of the day, it's a numbers game. So making those numbers add up when things are being focused on topics that people don't want to focus on. I mean, it's the same issue with my ad. Army didn't want to focus it on it anymore because people were mad about it. People are mad at the Army. People don't want to join the Army. If the Army starts talking about sexual assault, then maybe the public becomes too aware about it, and then people don't want to join. because, oh, wow, it is an issue, which we already knew, but now I'm seeing just how much of an issue it is and how big of a scale it is an issue. And so I think it's just a, well, where we're at right now, like, it's getting handled to some extent. People are still joining. You know, it hasn't completely fallen apart in front of our eyes. As much as the military wants to change it, there's so much more bureaucracy tied into those changes than people realize. The Vanessa Guillen documentary does a pretty good job into talking about, like, how much political advocacy has to happen for the military to see change. So is there definitely room for, like, leadership to change how cases currently are handled, or, like, how seriously they're taken, how seriously punishment is given out? Sometimes you're kind of withheld to, like, certain boundaries. Like, if you're an E7 in the Army, it takes, like, a congressional act to demote you. So usually if you're an E7 or if you're super close to retirement, they're still going to let you retire despite whatever crime might come out. But in order to get SHARP handled the way a lot of people want it handled, which is just outside of the Army as a whole, there's so much politically that needs to happen that I sadly do not think will happen, because too many congresswomen will argue that it takes away from the authority of commanders to take SHARP outside of the military, which was the whole argument that was put forth when the changes proposed by Vanessa Guillen's family were put out, that it shouldn't be up to your commander to decide what happens with you. It should be up to somebody else. And people are like, well, that takes away from the whole idea of the military, which is that your commander has, like, complete authority. And it eventually went through, obviously. But I think taking it out of the Army completely is such a longer and harder road that I'd like to hope someday it happens, but we'll see.
Israel has a serious problem with this, and they also have a huge, female unit in there.
It's actually, like, kind of you could say, like, Israeli political and social circles, sexual assault is one of the main arguments against continuing conscription.
Mm-hmm.
That's one of their, like the main arguments against it. That and the fact that they believe at this point in time it's kind of like an outdated institution, the conscription, where in which it's like they have enough people who are just professional soldiers that they don't need to continue conscripting everyone. One of the big points of debate is the sexual assault, where they're like, well, we can't just continue this because, like, if this is how people are being introduced, like, our young people are being introduced into the world, is through, like, the military, which seems to have just a toxic culture almost everywhere, which I don't know if that's something inherent to the military. It just, like, comes with the business and the institution, or if it's just bad, like, organization for human nature or whatever. But that's kind of one of their main reasons, is, like, trying to introduce these people, all these different types of people into the military at once, all when they're around the same age, usually leads to a lot of just bad social situations and almost kind of like a collective, like, nationwide psyche that just kind of fucks up the whole country.
Yeah.
And sexual assault is a huge part of that.
Well, because you look at, like, the people for, obviously not in places that have conscription, but, like, for the United States, if you look at the demographics of people who are joining and the ages that they're joining and their backgrounds, especially the enlisted population, because that obviously, you know, makes up the greater population of the Army. You're not having, like, Harvard educated, you know, like, these insanely smart savants with tons of life and social experience joining. And that's not to say that, like, that's what you need to be smart and successful. But for a lot of kids, the military is a way out of the place that they're at. And it's great that the military exists for that purpose, to be able to help people, you know, find more success in life and to get away from situations that aren't safe or aren't conducive, having a good quality of life. But I think a combination of the fact that a lot of people join at 18 straight out of high school. A lot of people join where this is their first job. A lot of people join where they've never lived away from home. A lot of people join where they suddenly have free range to access to alcohol, who don't have good sex education, who, you know, you combine all these different things and then you throw them in situations where they're just supposed to rely on each other to get through like hardship or whatever. There's so many cracks for negative things to come in and just break the entire system apart. Because I've seen units and people in the military who are like, this is the greatest thing I ever did. I love this. Like, and that's not to say that they don't know what they're talking about. And like, oh, they're crazy. How could they like this? This is horrible. There's people who are genuinely good leaders who run good organizations within the Army and who produce high morale, high energy, like units that are happy to serve, that are willing to deal with the hardships when they come, but know that they're supported, know that they can be successful, know that they're valued, you know all those different things. And I think the toxicity that comes in, it can be common, I think, in certain branches within the Army, but I think a big part of that is like individual leadership. You know, how do you handle issues where that camaraderie has been broken apart, which is, I mean, what happens when MST happens? Like, that breaks apart camaraderie, that breaks apart people's ability to trust each other.
And I think it's also just some of the stuff you're saying, if you think about it, it's some of the same problems people face when going to college, you know. And where else is sexual assault a huge problem? College. In dorms, you know, and that's when you have the alcohol and all that stuff, and it happens there too. And a lot of times universities do protect people. I mean, there's that one famous kid who was like a swimmer or something. And
Brock Turner. Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, there seems to be this like culture throughout the United States, like military and civilian, that is in this idea of like, oh, well, it's a mistake that a kid made. Not realizing like the far-reaching repercussions of that mentally. Because I mean, I haven't seen too many studies done about it, but I would be willing to bet, I want to say in the civilian world, the amount of women who face sexual harassment is something like 98% or something like that. Because I remember there being like a huge thing on Twitter a couple months ago where everybody was like, really only 2% of the world is safe. Like, that's insane, blah, 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 blah. I just remember seeing a bunch of stuff about it. So I might be wrong. But I wouldn't be surprised if the military is the exact same, if not more. And like, what that does to you, because for a lot of people, there's not an escape from that. I don't want to say there's an escape from it in college, but you don't go to college for 20 years. You go to college for 4 years, maybe 5 years, you know? But if you are in a situation where you, you know, for whatever reason, need to keep serving or just choose to keep serving, you can do a lot to your mental health to realize like, okay, well, I'm kind of just going to keep being in this organization where, you know, I'm prone for X, Y, and Z to happen to me, and I don't really know what I can do about it. And I just kind of have to hope that whatever place I'm in, you know, handles it well. And that I do get the support that I need. And because even like my situation, I would have never been worried about, you know, like somebody I experienced MST with, like being handled in the proper way or me being handled in the proper way. That was never a fear of mine, because my unit is supportive. My unit is very proactive. My unit does do a lot to, you know, support survivors and stuff like that. But that didn't even matter, because a different unit that I've had zero interaction with isn't that way. And so it's kind of a crappy situation, because really, until you can fix everybody, it doesn't really fix the situation. And it's hard to get down to the you know, battalion level across every single branch and be like, hey, we need to be taking this seriously. Hey, we need to handle this like this. Hey, I don't know if you're really fit to be in the position that you're in. Because, I mean, the priority is and has to be defense of the nation. So to be nitpicky about how this sergeant major handles this case or how this unit handles this survivor, I mean, it's just an issue on top of a dumpster fire of issues that the DoD already faces and deals with.
Connecting the two, I mean, if you really set education standards, it should be handled before these kids are getting into the military and college. And, you know, it really shouldn't even have to depend on the military to give this education because it should already be standardized to be there.
Yeah. It should be, like a predisposed thing that, because the military, where the military should step in then is that's where like the healthy relationships thing should be, you know, brought up and talked about. Because I think that's another thing that I've really also noticed since getting married and being dual mil is there's policies like MACP, which like allows you to be stationed with your spouse if you're both Army specifically. There's policies like that that are aimed to help service members have like quality family life, but there's not a ton that allows for healthy relationships. Because we get so, I mean, like I even am guilty of, you know, trying to keep my private life very far away from my military life for my own reasons. And I do have the communication skills to be able to communicate, you know, if I have an issue that needs to be brought forward. But for some of these kids that, you know, are married and are a lot younger or have kids and are a lot younger, they don't see a lot of examples of what to do. They just see a lot of examples of what not to do, which doesn't exactly help all the time. Because if you join the military married with kids, the second you get to your duty station, you're kind of just thrown to the wolves. Like you're like, hey, you know, figure out your house, figure out, you know, getting all the furniture, like, yeah, your household goods.
I saw you don't have a fridge or stove. How's that going?
Oh, yeah, I finally have one now. But yeah, like even in my marriage, like Josh is my best friend in the entire world, but we got married and 2 weeks later he started a deployment that he still is not back from. So even though we have a healthy relationship, that on its own creates, I don't even want to call it an issue, but a barrier that, I mean, is not healthy. Because if it were healthy, then civilian couples would take trips away from their spouse for extended periods of time. But nobody's going to volunteer to do that because it's not good for the relationship. You can make it through it, but it's so rare. I mean, that's why you see so many people going through divorces or struggling on deployments, and like that support aspect is rough. And I think it's because like sex and personal life has always been very taboo for the military. I mean, you have like the Hyde Amendment, which prevents talking about abortion on federal installations. And this kind of just follows that same trend of if we don't acknowledge it, then, you know, it's kind of like out of sight, out of mind. If we don't have policies that talk about, you know, family life, then it's like the military has this idea like, oh, if we hope that they know how to handle it on their own, then they'll just figure it out eventually, which is so weird to me because there's no other aspect of the military that is like that. The military will tell you how to cut your nails, cut your hair, tie your shoes, mow your lawn if you live on base. But then when it comes to like creating a healthy environment at home, they're like, we'll find out if you're not doing it. Because
speaking about that, what about like domestic abuse and stuff?
Yeah, like if there's domestic violence going on, then we'll figure out about it, and then we'll put you into like FAP, the Family Advocacy Program. But it's a terrible name. Figure it out until then. Yeah, I know.
That kind of relates to something I want to touch on. As far as the military goes, we know you guys get like some form of benefit packages, and just kind of what you've been going into, how a lot of people in the military kind of struggle with their personal life. How seriously does the military take things like therapy, counseling, like marriage counseling, psychiatric, like needs if you need them, stuff like getting you proper medication? Are they good at that, or is that something where it's like it kind of ties in with everything else where it's like it needs to be improved?
I think that's the one thing that the military does do a pretty solid job at. Again, this is based really with my experiences in my units, but I mean, even really that's ingrained in policy too. If you schedule a behavioral health appointment and somebody keeps you from going to that behavioral health appointment, that person gets chewed out to high heaven about why they did that. It's like something that they have tried to change and make more seriously. The issue with that is that the supply doesn't always equal the need. People wait an insane amount of time to actually be able to see a provider. And sometimes providers are stretched super thin. But I think there is a lot more support, and that culture has changed a lot in supporting mental health. And it's not like as much of a taboo thing as it used to be. And again, I'm sure like in combat units, it's a lot different. But even in the changes that I've seen in my service, there's been a big change from how behavioral health is handled, how much access you have to it, how many questions can be asked about it, and all that kind of stuff.
Another thing I kind of wanted to get you to like kind of expand on a little more, because we did touch up on it, and it kind of ties back to what we were saying about colleges and the dorms, which, having been to college myself and being in college, I think dorms are an insane idea, but that's a completely different topic. But this kind of relates to that. You talked about how the barracks setup is really just kind of, I guess you could say, a little bit unnecessary or not ideal. And again, I have friends who've been in the military. Some of them were in the military like 20 years ago. And a lot of them say, like, you know, when you really think about it, the barracks doesn't make a whole lot of sense in a lot of situations, you know.
It's one of those things that's left over from older things, just like yelling at you when you show up. You know, they had that in place because at Vietnam we conscripted people and you needed to yell at the kids.
And it's like, sure, in certain situations, maybe in basic training, it might make sense.
Yeah.
But I feel like kind of you like taking out the barracks where it doesn't need to be kind of go a bit of a ways to just mitigate this problem a little bit. I just kind of want to get your thoughts on that, the whole barracks setup, and like, is it outdated? Is it have benefits, et cetera?
It's kind of like a double-edged sword, because if you're talking about, you know, again, how the military doesn't try to help people like set healthy habits when it comes to personal lives. I mean, you kind of get into this like never-ending loop of
cycle.
Yeah, the cycle of like contradicting thoughts. Because on the one hand, yeah, barracks gives, I think, too many people access to know too much about you. In most cases, like, you'll have a tag on the front of your door that has your name, your number, who your leadership is, who that person's number is. I think that's way too much access to information. I think it causes other issues, defects. I hate DFAC food. I have refused to eat at the DFAC. Even when I wasn't getting BAS, I would just go to the commissary and buy groceries for myself because it just wasn't what I wanted.
What is DFAC?
The dining facilities. All the yummy, yummy military food.
Dining hall.
Yeah. So I think that there's a lot of bad that can be said. And then you go into like the military doesn't really, like, if we just abolish barracks, how is that going to help these kids who are fresh out of high school and young and first time living on their own? learn how to be adults if we're just kind of throwing them to the wolves. And then you go back to, okay, well, is that really the military's business? Does the military need to involve themselves heavily in every single person's personal life? Because then how do you pick apart like the, okay, you're 30 and you're joining, but you've never lived anywhere from home. So you need this like extra little bit of help. You're 18, but you got kicked out when you were 16. So you already know how to deal with this. Okay, you're 28, but you went to college and had life experience. So even though you're younger than this person who doesn't have as much, then you don't have to, you know, have the army check in on you with this, this, that, and the other. So it's rough because like there's a lot of policies that go into the barracks, like visiting hours, alcohol amount policies. Like out here, our soldiers can only have like one bottle of liquor and a 6-pack of beer in their fridge at a time. I might be wrong on that, but it's around that amount.
I'm just going to say that that seems pretty reasonable. The only downside to that I see is buying in bulk is generally cheaper.
Yeah. Well, for me, like my point with that is like I have a cocktail bar downstairs just so that way like I can make myself fancier drinks when I want to. Nobody's going to come into my house and be like, hey, why do you have like 5 different bottles of alcohol? So it's one of those things where it makes sense where the policy was born out of. It makes sense why the Army wants to do that. But then when you mix into it the fact that like that's not something that everybody is having to deal with, it gets rough.
But like kind of the rules need to be contextualized. Like in a way, like you're talking, like the example you just gave about the 28-year-old who joins the military. It's like he doesn't need, forgive me if I'm using incorrect terminology here, but like a superior officer watching over him at all times of day and making sure he's in uniform and his or her hair is like in the correct manner. I feel like when you're at that age, you kind of just need to be told once or twice and you get it.
But the context for the situation is always your marital status. And that's the issue. You can be 30 years old, having lived on your own since you were 16, but if you are not married, you are in the barracks and you are getting told how much alcohol you can have and you are getting room inspections from your superior and you are having to deal with, you know, 18-year-olds probably around you that, you know, want to party it up and drink. And so it's rough because yeah, the barracks to some essence provides for oversight for those who need it. It allows for there to be policies that, you know, cover how much alcohol you can have. It allows for there to be, you know, a CQ that can watch and make sure that, you know, nobody's burning the building down. But the one deciding factor that decides whether you're in the barracks or not is your marital status.
If you get divorced, they send you back to the barracks?
It depends. So we have had, well, I'm sure every unit has, you know, people that will get divorced after living out on your own. It depends on if you're in on-base housing, on off-base housing. It depends what rank you are at the time that you get divorced, how close you are to promoting again. So, like, most of the times if you're on an on-base house and you get divorced, automatic back into the barracks. Your family is no longer, like, entitled to things unless you retain custody of your children. Say it like for this case, we're just going to say that none of these people who are getting divorced have children. So if you don't have children and you just get divorced, then yeah, you go straight back into the barracks from your on-base house because you're not entitled to government housing anymore. If you are off base and you get divorced, most of the times, yeah, you can just keep the place because like leases and stuff like that. But if you're an E3 and you just got divorced, like, it's not unheard of to make that person move back in. It would be within the unit's rights if their like leasing time is up. And then you get into like rank issues. Like out here, we can live off base if we're an E5. So there's been a couple situations where we've had like E4s that have gotten divorced and their divorce process while they were in E4, but they're promotable and they're just waiting on points. They just get to stay off base because they're just going to end up moving like 3 times in the span of like a couple of months anyways. Divorce can change like how much you have to move or where you end up at, which is wild. Really, yeah, like the only thing that would change that is if you have kids. Because if you retain, I don't even think it's 50% custody. I think if you retain any custody of your child, then you have to have access to housing. That isn't the barracks because you can't have children in the barracks, obviously.
Let's just wrap with a little, what's next for you?
I finish my bachelor's in psychology, hopefully in December, which I absolutely trudged ahead on. Oh my goodness. I had a bunch of transfer credits, but about literally a year ago, I was like, you know what? I need to just start school. So I did an insane amount of semester hours for someone who's active duty. But the benefit to that is that I will have completed this entire degree in 2 years with my transfer credit. So I didn't do an entire degree in 2 years, but so I'll finish that up this year and then hopefully start applying to either master's programs or doctorate programs, depending on what I do better on testing wise. But yeah, I'm really just looking forward to my husband comes home eventually here soon. And this house that we're living in now, we just moved into before he left. So I'm excited to just get to enjoy a little bit more of normal life when he comes home. And that non-military side that is benefited by the military. Because yeah, I definitely would not
make
be...
it sound very, very normal.
It really is. I mean, like, I think that that's so, because even like on the influencer side, you do not see a lot of people. You don't see a lot of females in the military on the influencer side. And the ones that you do see, it's like Lujin, who's, you know, the PsyOps girl, where it still gets pulled so hardcore into military. And I feel like, I don't know, it's a funny concept, because you'll see girls talk all the time about like, I want to be able to travel without and make money and, you know, enjoy these cool foreign places and blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, that's the military, dude. Like, there's a lot of downsides to it, but there's also a lot of upsides. Like, I'm living in Japan for free. I get paid to live in Japan at that. You know, I have a fairly normal life outside of work, and, you know, bar us not having field ops or overnight ranges or anything like that, you know, I get to enjoy, I get to eat chilies, you know?
I'm gonna end it there.